Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Friday edition of the show. Two quick reminders. Number one, if you want to get access to the upcoming Q&A / AMA episode from Supercast subscribers, or you want to just get extra bonus content and support the work of The Realignment, you can go to realignment.supercast.com. Once again, that's realignment.supercast.com. There's also a link in your show notes right on top if you want to get access to the website where you can pay to support the show. $5 a month, $50 a year, $500 for a lifetime membership. Secondly, it's Friday, so the Substack is going out. Y'all should definitely go check it out. Today's a pretty fun day. Sagar and I are in Atlanta for the live show we're putting on for Breaking Points of Crystal and Kyle Kalinske. Hope to see some of you all there. Definitely shout out if you recognize me from the show or anything like that. On to today's episode. I am really obsessed with books about presidential leadership and history and how you really get through difficult moments in a country's history. Doing the episode about young JFK with Fred Logoval back in March was definitely one of the highlights of the year for me. So I've wanted to start adding on more content like this about presidents and these moments. So I'm speaking with the author, Jonathan Darman. He's the author of Becoming FDR, The Personal Crisis That Made a President. His other book, Landslide, LBJ and Ronald Reagan at the Dawn of New America, is the perfect book for understanding America during changing economic and political circumstances, with two incredibly important leaders for our country's history being right at the center of all of that. So huge recommendations. Check out the bookshop. With all that, hope you all enjoy this episode, and I will see you all next week after a great weekend. Jonathan Darman, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited to speak with you. Like I mentioned before we started recording, I'm a huge fan of Landslide, your previous book about LBJ and Ronald Reagan, really in 1964 through 1968. And at the same time, your new book, which is called Becoming FDR, about his relationship with polio and his latter presidency, is really fascinating. So a lot of things we're going to hit here. Let me just start as broadly as possible. It seems like the country is in a really difficult moment right now. Everyone would agree with that statement from various different directions. To what degree does a difficult moment seem to necessitate a single figure like a great president? Or if you're looking at history, do you kind of see it moving forward through this thing happened, then that thing happened, and things kind of stacked up together? Like, how do you think through that when you're writing a book like this?
Yeah. I mean, I would say generally, I am not a big fan of the idea that we have to look to an individual to solve all of our problems, because I think that can lead us to a dangerous place. It can make us attribute sort of godlike qualities to presidents that, in the wrong hands, that they can take to a pretty dangerous place. And it also sort of takes a lot of the responsibility off of the rest of us to sort of think about what the kind of country we want is and what the sort of most practical way to approach solving our problems should be. If we just think, oh, if only we had a Washington or a Jefferson or a Lincoln or an FDR. However, as someone who's just written a book about FDR, you know, honestly, what really drew me to the topic was trying to understand how it is that in a moment of dire crisis, so in FDR's case, the Depression and World War II, you have a leader who can connect with the country and sort of inspire hope in such a way that people are able to look beyond their very difficult present circumstances and believe that a better day is coming and that the country can come together and do big things. I think FDR is the best, most recent example we have of that. And it's something that's been a challenge in a lot of our recent presidencies. And so that's sort of what drew me to the topic of FDR in the first place. I honestly didn't think when I set out to write this book that it was going to end up being a story about polio, because I was interested in that question about inspiring hope. And it was only really when I sort of dug into FDR and tried to get inside his head that I came to understand that polio was a completely different story from what I'd thought. I thought that the sort of significance of it was the steps that FDR took to sort of deceive the country and conceal his disability. And if it showed anything about his character, it was just sort of his native optimism. And what I discovered instead is that polio is really the sort of great learning experience, character shaping experience for FDR, this thing that completely shakes up his life and forces him in the middle of life, age 39, that's when he gets polio, to learn a whole new set of skills and develop these gifts like empathy and strategic thinking and this sort of genius for inspiring for hope that are going to be all the things that allow him to do that thing we were just talking about of connecting with the country and convincing people to come along with him as they attempt to do big things.
You know, it's interesting. Everything you're articulating about FDR and polio brings to mind a everlasting question. Can people change? FDR is 39, midlife crisis era, and he goes through something more than just buying a Ferrari because he feels like it or having an affair with another woman because he's needs to feel
younger. I'm 41,
younger.
I should say, by the way. So this is all a very sensitive topic you're getting into here.
I'm a young looking 30. So okay. I'm directionally feeling that. But do you think, to answer the question of do you think people can change, describe pre-polio FDR, because this is something I think folks just aren't aware of. Like, I don't think most folks know that he was a vice presidential nominee. They don't know that he was, you know, a young state senator, but also filling Theodore Roosevelt's role in the Navy during World War I. Like, tell that FDR first.
Yeah, that's a great place to start, because I think you're right. Even a lot of people who think they know about history don't know much about FDR. He had a whole career in politics before he got polio. What's important to understand about that career is it was guided by this sort of single-minded ambition that he was going to be just like his cousin, Teddy Roosevelt, who was the sort of most famous, most impressive politician of the day. And so FDR's whole political persona was about he's a Democratic Roosevelt, he's the Democratic reincarnation of Teddy, and he does a really good sort of Teddy impersonation. He comes to Washington in 1913 as the assistant secretary of the Navy. And like, he starts using the word bully a lot. And he's very shrewdly figures out early on that reporters really like this story about another Roosevelt in town.
He's married to his niece. It's very literal.
Exactly. I mean, the Roosevelts are sort of like in some ways, the closest thing we have to a dynastic family in this country. And there is this sort of, it's like a sort of power marriage from the past where he's drawn to Eleanor Roosevelt in his early life for a number of reasons, but yeah, I mean, I think the fact that, she's the niece of Teddy Roosevelt, who at that time was the president of the United States, was one thing that really made the young FDR think his cousin Eleanor would be a great match for him. And so that's sort of like his whole guiding thing is I'm going to be the next Teddy Roosevelt. And it's kind of superficial. I think he has this sort of abstract concept of progressive ideas and of service to others, but it never really gets rooted in real experience. And the system by and large rewards him for that. So like in 1920, he gets put on the Democratic ticket as the vice presidential candidate, in large part because like people love the way he looks running around the floor of the Democratic convention. They think like, oh, that's an attractive, dashing young man. He looks like a young man in a hurry, and they put him on the ticket. And I think, you know, you can see in that campaign a lot of his sort of limitations. He doesn't have any of the sort of strategic ability that is going to like serve him so well in the future. He doesn't even have the rhetorical prowess that he's going to develop in the years ahead. And you can look at that man and say, what if he'd never gotten polio? What if like his life had just continued according to plan, trying to be the next Teddy Roosevelt? It's possible that he might have ended up in the White House someday, but I don't think that you could argue at all that there's any chance that that young man would be a great president and would be able to do all the things that Franklin Roosevelt did.
What's so interesting in terms of the way you're articulating this story, he's able to actually do the Theodore Roosevelt thing. Like once again, like state senator in New York, 28, so similar ages. He is in the papers for all that, Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And then to your point, when he gets polio, he's 39. That's the same year that Theodore Roosevelt goes up San Juan Hill during the actual, you know, Spanish-American War. So he's there at that kind of, to your point, superficial level. Here's a question that comes to mind when you're thinking of these presidents. To what degree, let me take a step back and rephrase this. So I work in tech mostly. And something you often hear is you'll see founders of startups just try to kind of copy someone else. So it's 2013, everyone's kind of dressing like Mark Zuckerberg, or it's like 2021 and everyone's trying to be like a Web3 founder. They're just following a previous model of what success looks like. Yeah. And oftentimes that next Mark Zuckerberg isn't going to look like Mark Zuckerberg. Can you just kind of talk broadly about this idea of like, how do politicians balance the art of, okay, this is a strategy that works. Here are vulnerabilities or opportunities in the system versus I'm going to forge my own path and do my own thing. Like, how do you think about that?
I think I should say that before I wrote books about presidents from the past, I covered people who were running for president in our own time. I think most politicians that you meet don't think very much about forging their own path. They think they're forging their own path, but in their own minds, they're just trying to be, you know, their generation's JFK, or they're trying to be their generation's Barack Obama. You know, I think like you see that a lot with people who are like a Ron DeSantis right now. He's talking, you know, there's this idea that he's got to seize his moment because Obama understood that in 2008, that even though people were telling him it was too soon for him to run, that he only got one shot and you should take your moment. And I think it, you know, they buy into this sort of lore, and they especially, I mean, the DeSantis and Obama isn't a perfect example of that here, but especially if it's a comparison that they like, I mean, everyone wants to be the next JFK. And I think what's so refreshing about FDR's polio story is it's the opposite. It's the moment when he gets his plan completely ripped out from under him, and there's no map. From there, there's no one saying, yes, you know, the way to become president is to, you know, spend 7 years in convalescence and rehabilitation, completely away from politics. And yet that's the period where he has the most growth and he really comes to a fuller understanding of himself and what he can do in the world.
You know, it's funny, you definitely didn't do this on purpose, but thinking of the three politicians who you've written about, LBJ, Reagan, and FDR now, obviously, each of them at midlife has this real knocked off the path bit. You know, LBJ is the definition, especially considering he doesn't come from wealth or privilege in the way that FDR does. He's the definition of like a young man in a hurry. And then he loses his Senate race in the early 1940s and has to basically spend 8 years in the desert figuring it out. Ronald Reagan goes from, you know, being a top of the B-list actor who's, you know, influential because of the guild to basically being a pitchman and having to figure that out. And now FDR. So to what degree do you think that greatness, and we're defining greatness not in terms of endorsing every single decision these people made, but on the pantheon of great presidents, they are obviously there. To what degree do you think that kind of middle age cataclysm is necessary for shaping or taking things to that next level?
I think it's present in the three men that I've written about, I focused on that for all three of them. And in LBJ's case, I would add a sort of late middle age version of it, which is the vice presidency under John F. Kennedy, where he had been the leader of the Senate Democrats in the 1950s in the Eisenhower era. And he was really, like, after Eisenhower, the most powerful man in the country. There's a scene I remember from working on that book where, like, they're trying to get votes. They're trying to line up votes for some important piece of legislation. And LBJ's solution, and they want to make sure that the right senators are there and the wrong senators aren't there. And LBJ's solution is to sort of take control of the air traffic control tower at National Airport in Washington to make the senators come in one by one in the right order. You know, that's power. And then he becomes vice president under John F. Kennedy, and it's just this extended exercise in humiliation. It's the power being taken away from him. And that's sort of where Landslide starts, is looking at him in that moment of abject humiliation and sort of finding a way out of it. I think it's true of so many presidents. I mean, look at, you know, Ulysses Grant. If you read about his life in the years before the Civil War, I mean, it's humiliation in the like most extreme sense. Like, he's not able to put food on the table for his family, and he's worried about, you know, just about, you know, disgracing himself in public as a man who can't take care of himself. And I think that, you know, I haven't spent a lot of time studying Grant, but, you know, in terms of the qualities you want in a president, which is like to sort of not believe a lot of the spin that's being put your way about how everything's great. I think it's a really important thing to go through, to understand that the future doesn't always work out the way that the sort of rosy prognostications are going to say they are, and that you have to be prepared for uncertainty in life. And on the flip side, that when things look really bad, there's a way out that you don't see as well. I think having that understanding, I think John F. Kennedy had it. I think that Ronald Reagan had it. I think that FDR certainly had it. I mean, I think that Teddy Roosevelt certainly had it. If you look at the experience of losing his first wife and the way that that changed him, I think he needs something. There's a line from Frances Perkins, who was FDR's labor secretary and knew him for decades beforehand. She talks about FDR's polio, and she says, you know, he might have, I'd like to think he would have been able to do all the things that he did in life without getting polio, but he probably would have needed something else to knock him in the face in life. And I think that a lot of, like, any good president probably needs something like that, that sort of knocks them out of their sense of certainty and their own wonderfulness, and gives them a sense that life is full of uncertainty.
You know, just to put a further pin on how devastating that death of TR's first wife was, his mother died the same night in the same house. So it's just a level of, there's just something about the 19th century, obviously, that even being fabulously wealthy couldn't really guard for that. I'm curious, as you're thinking about the stories of these men specifically, and then adding in Ulysses S. Grant, it seems so contrasted with how just clean and straightforward and packaged the present political moment feels. I'm curious how you think about evaluating, like, present day politicians, just given every single dynamic that you're suggesting, because it seems like by the metrics you're establishing for not just greatness in the, like, capital G greatness sense, but the sense of doing your job well, fulfilling people's actual needs, winning a majority, those different bits, it doesn't seem like our process right now is set up to encourage any of those bits. So how do you just think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest personal takeaway that I have from this project that I've done with FDR is really made me rethink the way we evaluate politicians when they talk about hope. I mean, hope is this word that gets used so frequently in our politics that it's become sort of meaningless. We sort of, like, glaze over when we hear it because we expect a politician to say it, but that's unfortunate because it's the thing we all need. And it's hard to find sometimes. So I really think what I take away from all of this is, when we're evaluating politicians talking about hope, we ought to say, when was the time that they needed hope in their own lives? And what did they learn from that experience? So FDR's experience needing hope teaches him all sorts of practical things. In his experience recovering from polio, you know, he had to sort of embrace this spirit of empiricism of, okay, I don't, you know, he had this idea, he gets polio, it takes away the ability to walk on his own. He gets this idea that he's going to regain the ability to walk. And there's no clear path for how he should do that. So he has to sort of commit himself to these long-term plans and schemes of rehabilitation that may or may not pan out. And that gives him a sort of tolerance for uncertainty. Eleanor Roosevelt talks about, you know, polio giving him the ability to make a decision and then draw the curtain and go to sleep. And I think that if you look at FDR's presidency and the kind of decisions he had to make, particularly in the war, you know, massive consequential decisions about, you know, which front you're gonna focus on and when you're gonna do a you know, invasion of where, and you're really not gonna know how that plays out for months or even years at a time, but civilization is literally on the line. That's a lot to get comfortable with. And I think FDR was able to do that because he'd had so much experience with that in his own life.
No, it's interesting. I want to go back to a early thing with the conversation, this idea of not wanting, especially when you're coming at this from a historian's perspective, to just like look at the individual and say that's everything. But we just live in an age where the individual is everything. Institutions don't matter. The Democratic Party doesn't matter. The Republican Party doesn't even have a party platform anymore. Like if Ron DeSantis beats Trump in the 2024 primary, it's going to be because of Ron DeSantis. Right. It's just my basic take there. Donald Trump beat Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz because he was Donald Trump. Same thing of President Obama when he was candidate Obama in 2008. So can you just like reflect on that? Like just how it's super depressing, actually, and that definitely because you are just reducing everything to what seems like an individual and their specific ability to navigate these incredibly difficult dilemmas. But that's just my takeaway, which is like, man, whoever can do whatever it is has to be someone who would be that level of an individual.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, this is something I struggle with a lot, frankly, because I think if you look at, I mean, politics has changed a lot just in my adult lifetime. In terms of this sort of celebrity factor that gets attached to it. And you look at, you know, I'm not someone who's a fan of Donald Trump. And you look at why someone like Donald Trump would have wanted to sort of seek the presidency in 2016. And before that, actually, he was interested in it briefly, we think, in 2012. And I think it's because all of a sudden he realized that it was this way to be the biggest celebrity in the world. And I think that there's, you know, it is because it's sort of removed itself just from the realm of like, this is what practical politicians aspire to being this sort of office that, you know, you're the greatest person in the world. Now, there was always some of that. I think we were talking about Teddy Roosevelt before, and he had this sort of like heroic quality that like, you know, people attached a lot of sort of romantic meaning to in his time, but he still had to sort of operate within the constraints of a conventional party system. And as you see in the Teddy Roosevelt example, like that leads him to a place of great frustration. You know, he tries to run on his own outside of the Republican Party in 1912, and he loses because being Teddy Roosevelt, even if you are the most famous person in the country, isn't enough to get you the presidency without a party structure behind you. I think now it's a quite different scenario where you have the sort of parties, particularly the Republican Party, melding themselves to the individuals who are the face of them. And I think you're right. It's very much in line with the sort of influencer culture in which we live.
Yeah, it's interesting because putting it that way, when it comes to the Bull Moose Run in 1912. Today, Theodore Roosevelt wins because the tools that the institutional party is able to utilize to win, despite the fact that TR was winning all the primaries, which didn't actually count, that's actually kind of the point, didn't really exist. Another question I'd ask is, you know, in the first chapter, you really write that this book initially came out of trying to answer a question, like that question being like, how does someone unify during these tough times? And this is where I want to merge this with your previous book, Landslide, like once again about in the 1964, like mid period, where the 1950s post-World War II consensus is starting to fray. How important is unity or prioritizing unity over your side winning? This is a debate I'm kind of curious. I'll make it more clear because this is just coming from conversations I have with my friends. So basically, the more center left someone is, the more likely they are to tell me, I want unity. I want the country to unify. How do we overcome these problems? And when I talk to my most reasonable Trumpy friends, what they will tell you is, yeah, like obviously like Trump sucks, in a variety of very straightforward ways you could articulate. But as I look at the country right now, and this is kind of the theme of Landslide, there are two visions for the country right now, and our side needs to win, and we could unify afterwards. Because if we don't win, the country is doomed anyways. What would you say to someone who basically reflects that sort of idea?
I definitely think that it's the root of a lot of our problems. So in Landslide, I talk about how this sort of moment in the 1960s where both sides start to become detached from reality. So you have Lyndon Johnson, who comes into the presidency after John F. Kennedy, and he wants to be a better president than John F. Kennedy was because he's sort of haunted by the Kennedy myth. And he wants to be basically as great a president as Franklin Roosevelt, who was his hero, talking about what we were talking about before with these politicians, like they want to follow a path. Like LBJ very much was like focusing on what do I do to be exactly like FDR? But in the process of doing that, he starts making all these really grand promises for what government can do to make people's lives better that get way out of whack with reality. And that creates this sort of opening that hadn't really been there in the post-war period up to that point for someone like Ronald Reagan to come in and sort of revive the right and with this idea that the problem is government. And when you have that become the sort of debate, like we either need government to solve all our problems or government is the problem, no one really ever has to reckon with reality. And it creates this sort of deep fracture that ends up with, I think, the sort of parallel universe that you were just describing. I think, like, you know, unity is not an end in and of itself. I think that, like, moral purpose should be...
We were pretty unified on the Iraq war, right? So it's...
Right, you know, exactly.
93 to, you know, 5.
Yeah. And I mean, and I think, like, you know, FDR... is someone who was able to get huge majorities of the country to believe in his program, but he had plenty of rhetoric that people on cable news today would call divisive, you know? And like when he's running for re-election in 1936, at the end of the campaign, he talks about this sort of grand conspiracy of moneyed interests that are organized against him. And he says, you know, they're united in their hate for me and I welcome their hatred. But in the same speech, he talks about how what's really going to save the Republic is peace and love and goodwill among men. And so like he's literally doing both things, the unifying and the attacking in the same speech. And I think it works because for FDR, it's coming from a place of actual conviction. He believes that getting his program through is this sort of vital thing that he needs to do to make the country better and to make people's lives better.
You know, it's interesting, given everything we're describing, me mentioning the Iraq war makes me think of George W. Bush. And I'm curious how you would reflect upon George W. given everything we've been discussing. So once again, another man, there's something about age 40, a man who at 40,
right,
stops drinking, cold turkey, force of will, becomes... Gene Edward Smith did the most recent big Bush biography, and he makes reference to the fact that it's arguably George W. Bush was like our most fit president in terms of like pouring his mental will and energy there, transforms his life, becomes a popular governor, beats Ann Richards, all these things. And then he's given this moment and he, you know, he has the famous Yankees pitch after 9/11. He has this unifying moment. It's really just, I was in fourth grade when September 11th happened, so I don't remember this part actively. But when you read back about September 12th to basically December 2001, you're like, oh my God, he could have done anything.
Right.
But he couldn't take these similar level experiences to FDR, Reagan, LBJ, and translate it. Like what went wrong there beyond just like the obvious policy implications? I'm curious at a character study level.
It's a really good question. And I think that, during the Bush presidency, there was a ton of what the Bush family called putting George W. on the couch, which they hated.
Because it's fascinating. There's a lot there.
I mean, and like there was a lot, you know, I think, you know, if you were in fourth grade when 9/11 happened, I was a bit older. I was a junior in college. There was a lot of rage in the months immediately after 9/11. I think it's hard in a certain way for us to remember now, because at that point, it was the end of this period where America had sort of seemed invincible in the world. So, you know, like basically from the end of the Cold War through 9/11, the United States is the sole superpower, and the stakes for most things seemed pretty low. And I think a lot of us, like in the world that I grew up in, you sort of took for granted that that was going to be the way it was forever. We don't think that way now, because we've had a lot of sort of reminders that the United States is not invincible in the 20 odd years since then. But that, I think a lot of that rage came from that, just sort of like, how on earth did this happen? You know, how did these people, you know, do this to the United States of America, the greatest power in history? And there was just this sort of like huge outpouring of, you know, we've got to do something about this. And I think that George W. Bush felt that behind him. And it was sort of like, you know, pretty aggressive. And so it wasn't like, I mean, there were all sorts of things he could have done in that moment. He could have said, like, we're going to solve all these domestic problems. We're going to take advantage of this unity that we have. Because there had been a lot of talk in the 10 years before that about sort of how America was this great military force, but we had crumbling infrastructure and we had a terrible education system. And, you know, he could have really said, like, taken that unity that he had and like really attacked those problems. But I think he would have been going against this sort of big current that was in the electorate of like a desire, frankly, for a sort of violent vengeance. And he channeled that, for whatever reason, into this sort of catastrophic mistake of Iraq. I haven't thought enough about it, because I think you're so right to look at George W. Bush as someone who has a midlife sort of
rebirth
epiphany. Yeah, exactly.
It's
the same.
It's that deep. It's a real thing.
Exactly. And I guess, you know, it creates in him this sense of God. You know, he believes that God saved him, and he's pursuing God's purpose. I don't really know enough about why. I haven't studied it closely enough to sort of get beyond the sort of things that we used to talk about, which is, you know, avenging his father. You know, Saddam Hussein had tried to kill his father, also trying to outdo his father. His father ended the Iraq war without going to Baghdad. He was going to go to Baghdad. But I think what's interesting is, for whatever reason, his sort of big midlife rethink doesn't give him the same quality that we see as a positive in a lot of these other presidents, of sort of skepticism. I think when you look at the buildup to the Iraq war, that's what was absent, was skepticism. Well, okay, what's going to happen after we depose Saddam? And you look at someone like FDR, and I think that a lot of those questions would have been asked, because he would have had this sort of deeper conviction that, again, like, the sort of rosy scenarios don't always come to pass.
You know, as you're articulating that, like, my take on the issue here is it's obviously more than just you need to have a midlife crisis and then you got the seeds of greatness. It's that your midlife crisis has to teach you the right lesson and give you the right trait. The lesson of George W. Bush's midlife crisis is sometimes you can be a fail son and then bottom out, and just through sheer force of will, stop drinking. The story there, if you're him, is, wow, this is about my certainty. This is about me being the decider. I'm going to, it's the exact wrong trait that you would want to have going into your point, that transition from the post-Cold War era to 9/11. To the run-up to the Iraq war. Certainty is the wrong trait. So in FDR's case, the real important thing here is his crisis gives him a specific set of traits that didn't just put him back on the path to the presidency, because we didn't mention this, but the reason why most people don't know that, you know, FDR was the vice presidential nominee in 1920, it was a total blowout. Yeah. So it's hard to imagine him pulling it together miraculously. So it sets him on the path. And George W. Bush was set on the path through his epiphany, but it didn't also give him the trait he needed to navigate the specific crisis that the universe gave him.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough stuff, right? Like, yeah. I mean, getting anyone who can stop drinking in midlife, if they have a problem, like that's an incredibly hard thing to do. And I think you look at George W. Bush and the qualities that he brought to the presidency, he did have this sort of fanatical discipline. And you could create all sorts of sort of, rationales for why that was exactly what you want in a presidency. And that was sort of very much in the air at the time, was like, there was a sense that Bill Clinton had this sort of loosey-goosey presidency, you know, people in the Oval Office in t-shirts and jeans. And George W. Bush was going to come in and insert order.
The MBA president. That's the
MBA president. Exactly. Yeah. And everyone was in a suit and tie. And you know, there's a sort of they would put out these statements about, we're going to pick a cabinet secretary by this date, and they would do it. And I think, you know, at the time, like, that looks like, oh, that's smart. You know, they're running it like a business. But what gets lost in the process is the real sort of spirit of inquiry and deliberation that's gonna dredge up some of the more unpleasant facts that you really need to pay attention to when you're president.
Something I'm thinking back, and this is to your point, the underlying theme of landslide. You're describing how at a core level, LBJ and Reagan ignored reality. What is reality in this country right now? It makes you think of like how like De Gaulle, the quote is, I have a certain idea of France. That's his way of articulating, I have an idea of France. I know what France is. I know what France needs. And that's a successful leadership for him. But like, what is reality?
I think it's really hard right now because we all live through in our own particular realities. And I think, you know, talking again about another lost opportunity, the early months of the pandemic were a moment where reality, we all were sort of living in the same reality, right? There was this terrifying, mysterious thing, and it disrupted everyone's life. It disrupted people's lives to different degrees. Like if you were in a blue state, it probably was more disruptive, but particularly in the first weeks, mm-hmm. you know, a lot shut down in this country. And I think, you know, I'm glad that Donald Trump didn't take advantage of the moment politically, but another president in that moment could have sort of used that moment where everyone is, for the first time in a while, living in the same reality and say, okay, this is what we're experiencing. I'm going to describe it to you accurately. And I'm also going to describe what we know and what we don't know and what I think the path out of here is. That's what FDR did in the early days of his presidency, when it looked like the United States economic system was going to collapse. He, like, you know, if you look at his fireside chats, they're not soaring oratory. They are very sort of detailed and sometimes even dense documents that describe the situation. And it sort of assumes that people want this level of detail. And I think that comes very much out of the experience of being someone who's had a serious illness. When you are seriously ill and a doctor comes to talk to you, you want the details. You want, you know, you don't say, oh, don't bore me with details. You want the details and you want to know what the next steps are going to be. And I think he understands that people in 1933 are worried about, are they going to be able to put food on the table? Are they going to be able to withdraw funds from the bank? And so there's no level of detail that's going to be too much for them. They want us, it's going to make them feel better to have a sophisticated understanding. So you need these sort of moments that wrench you back into reality, and it's harder and harder today, but I think it is possible. And hopefully we won't have another experience anytime soon where reality sort of asserts itself. But I also hope that when it does happen, we have a president who's better able to sort of meet that moment.
You know, another thing coming from the landslide theme here is really just treating 64 as this pivot point. And something I'm curious about, because this has shaped how I've thought about, let's say, Liz Cheney. What happens when you have people who, Liz Cheney obviously thought she was going to be either Speaker of the House or President someday. And she is now basically because of circumstance on the other side of a changing America. The right has changed. She's kind of in the position that Nelson Rockefeller and the Country Club Republicans, the moderates, were. And I'm curious how you think a figure like Liz Cheney or Ronald Reagan, how do you think they decide when do I shift? Or, you know what, maybe history has just left me behind, which is what most Country Club Republicans are eventually forced to do. There's no perfect answer because we're to a certain degree putting people on the couch, but I'm just basically kind of wondering, like, what's stopping Liz Cheney from just saying, you know what, I'm basically a Democrat now. Mm-hmm. And instead of launching an independent party run, I could give my own version of the Ronald Reagan time for choosing speech in 2024. I could say, the only choice that matters this election is democracy, yay or nay. And that choice means you should either vote for Biden or Pete Buttigieg or whoever they basically pick. And then she's just a Democrat. That's what Reagan's able to do. I don't think she's going to do that. But like, how do you just think through like how politicians like think through these processes?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's in most politicians' DNA to think of themselves as a figure of the past. You know, I think once they do that, they're basically staring down the grave.
Yeah.
And you know, there's this sort of cliche about anyone who runs for president never stops running. They either win or they die.
You always
hold out the hope. And I think you're always thinking. So I think, you know, I have a hell of a lot of admiration for what Liz Cheney has done in the past year and change, because there's no way that you could argue that it's coming from a place of personal political opportunism. If she wanted to follow, you know, look at what's happening in the House leadership right now. If she had just been mildly Trumpy and sort of waited in the wings and tried to not get too mixed up in things, she could easily still be someone who's in a good position to be the next Speaker of the House. And she was able to turn away from that. And I think nothing drove that except principle. But I think when you look at someone like Reagan in the 60s, because I talk about this in Landslide, like, he's a Goldwater supporter. He does that famous speech for Barry Goldwater in 1964. But he's not devoting his life to the Goldwater effort because he doesn't think that Barry Goldwater is going to get elected president in 1964. And Reagan is someone who he's an ideologue and he's an idealist, but he's also a pragmatist when it comes to his own self-interest. And I think that if you know, a lot of really successful politicians, that's the case. And so if you assume that Liz Cheney is in that camp, I think she's got to be thinking, this is the way the world is now. This is the way the two parties are now. But that doesn't mean that this is the way they will always be. And there's pretty good evidence, both from history, you know, deep history and also recent history, to support that conclusion. I mean, look at the different ways we think about Mitt Romney now versus the way we thought about him 10 years ago. So, you know, we'll see where things end up for Liz Cheney.
Yeah, and to your point about, I'd say Mitt Romney is the exception to the always thinking about being president rule. I think one of the things he's been able to do in this latter half of his life is, you know, he runs obviously in 2008, he wins the nomination in 2012. I think he's been able to put that to the side, and he seems to be having a much better time, quote unquote, now that he's doing that. Something I'm curious about too is, a huge theme of Landslide, obviously, is California and how, in many ways, like that's presaging the future of the country. And in FDR's case, he's governor of New York and he tries out many New Deal programs there. I asked this to a previous guest this week. Where do you kind of see as the country's center of gravity right now at a state level? In either party. So like, you could argue right now, like, you will, because DeSantis and Trump are both Florida based, you could say that Florida is the center of the country. Obviously there are huge battles over like Hispanic voters and abortion voters in Texas. California is always kind of in a weird place if you're a Democrat now. Like, where do you kind of see the equivalence of all the energy focusing today?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think a lot of people would say Florida. I hope that's not the case, because I think Florida is a pretty unique thing. I think that if you look at the United States in the 60s, as I describe it in Landslide, California is important because it's sort of a proxy for where suburban Americans are going to go. It represents the sort of suburban ideal in the 1960s. And like people in the suburbs are still really important in our politics. They led the sort of Democratic swing in 2018. They got Biden over the top barely in 2020. Whatever, however things shake out this year, whether if it's a good Republican year in 2022, it's going to be because they're able to convince enough people in the suburbs that the Republican Party is not totally extreme and crazy, and that they can vote for them and use them as a vessel for some of their discomfort with Joe Biden and the Democrats. So I think that's always a pretty good rule. Is pay, you know, we talk about sort of urban elites and rural Americans a lot, but pay attention to people in the suburbs, because the sort of way that politics gets broken down on their level can be a good barometer of where things are. And suburbs mean something very different now from what it meant in the 1960s. I think in the 1960s, it was sort of like a way of talking about white new members of the middle class. Now, American suburbs now are much more racially diverse. They're more economically diverse, but they are still as a sort of they're a place where the sort of what cliched kitchen table issues get worked out and talked about in a way that is going to have big consequence in terms of who wins elections.
So I'd say the last question I've got for you here is, and I'm going to keep using the titles because the titles are good, like landslides, like a landslide. Like that's the key thing. Like LBJ, FDR, they win landslide elections and are able to implement their vision. Reagan wins landslides, and because of the Democratic Senate and the Democratic House at various points, it's a little complicated. He isn't able to implement a policy program at the same level as FDR and LBJ, but at a almost philosophical level, he's able to change the country that way. Like the way his model, this is why I was always insane that the Hillary Clinton campaign attacked Obama for saying that like Reagan transformed the country in a way that Bill Clinton didn't, is like, that was just hacky to say that wasn't true, because it's just true. Like the blueprint is still there. And in many ways, we're still, in both good ways and bad ways, like contained within like Reagan's vision of what America is. So what do you think it would really take to get a landslide today? And is that something we should be looking for, from a one side gets to, in good faith, implement their vision, and we move on to maybe like the next set of issues?
Well, being I have to say that working on this book, Becoming FDR, has made me a sort of long-term optimist.
Interesting.
I think, and this gets back to your question about how much we should look to an individual to affect change, and whether a single individual can. I think if you had someone who was really able on a sustained basis to talk about hope in a meaningful way that people found realistic, there would be a very large constituency for that in this country right now, because people have gone through a lot in the last few years, the pandemic, the 2020 election, its aftermath. Like, I think there's a broad middle in this country that doesn't like how terrifying things have felt. So if someone was able to sort of break through that and say, this is the path back or the path forward to something more normal, and actually and even hopeful, I think that would have a big constituency. And I think, again, it's so grounded in the individual's own experience. So I always come back to this line that FDR said when he was accepting the Democratic nomination in the summer of 1932. He said, out of every crisis, mankind rises with some share of greater knowledge, of higher decency, and of purer purpose. And I mean, we all really want to believe that, that after everything we've been through, we're not just going to be okay. We're going to come out better. And I think FDR was able to convince people of that in 1932, a really dark moment in our history, because he believed it. And he believed it because he had lived it in his own life. And I think that another politician who has that same life experience backing up his hopeful promises could do a lot to sort of change the political dynamic in this country.
Yeah, because it's like you said, it has to be, the key takeaway is authenticity. It can't be a hallmarked, staged, managed version. It has to actually be something deeply true if it leads to substance. Jonathan, this has been really great. I've wanted to speak with you for a while, so I'm excited that we could do this. And I'm glad to hear that this project has left you a long-term optimist, because that describes, frankly, like reading these styles of books. These books are anti-doomerism for me, because it just convinces me, once again, not everything is purely on the individual, but given the nature of our system, the Lincolns, the FDRs, the Reagans, the LBJs, like they are produced, and there's this kind of organic, semi-inorganic process. And I think if we had a bunch of FDRs on the stage, if things weren't working, I would then be much more doomerist. But right now, my take is basically, hey, guess what? It turns out we're probably in the 1880s to 1890s right now. The country's changing. There are a bunch of challenges. Grover Cleveland, try as he might, just isn't going to be a person. He could do a fine job. You could pass civil service reform. He isn't going to get America over that specific hump of that challenge. I think that's a way of describing now too. So thank you so much for joining me on The Realignment.
This was great. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.